From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Ingleside.
I live in Sausalito.
I live in the East Bay, Hercules, California, USA, planet Earth.
Coming up, politicians and economists duke it out over how to solve the Bay Area's affordable housing crisis.
We have built less than half of the housing in this region the state estimates that we need based on population growth.
Then we'll hear how San Francisco's preparing for that growth by streamlining Muni.
If I had my way, we wouldn't have schedules. Like, if you're riding on Geary during rush hour, there'd be a bus every 3 minutes. It's not necessarily going to be at 6:27. It might be at 6:30, but there's going to be one every 3 minutes.
And we meet a Bay Area blues band that's getting some rave reviews.
He said, "You guys are the most rhythmic white people I've ever met." That was very cool.
That is cool. It's Cross Currents. In one of America's most expensive cities, there's a fringe political party whose name sums up their concerns. The rent is too damn high. The city is New York, but rent here in San Francisco is even higher. And while no party around here has been quite so blunt about it, organizations are taking action. The Bay Area Council Economic Institute hosted a housing forum earlier this year, and the conversation showed there are many ways to look at the problem and many ways to disagree on how to solve it. KALW's Liz Mack has the story.
But then you get the benefit of, you can build more units in that same location despite existing.
Let's be honest. This is a forum on housing policy, so it's not the most riveting stuff. Except for one thing. The people speaking at the forum don't seem to like each other much. Check out economist Chris Thornburg taking a swipe at one of his fellow panelists, San Francisco supervisor David Campos.
You know, as an economist, I'm not used to dealing with politicians. And, you know, they have a certain way of, you know, first demonize your opponent, second, distort what he just said, and then third, make your case as passionately as humanly possible, hoping that everybody notices fails to notice the complete lack of logic in what you just said.
So that's the speakers are going to butt heads plenty, but they're not here just to jab at each other. They're looking for solutions to the housing crisis.
But the big picture is that over the course of the past 7 years, we have built less than half of the housing in this region the state estimates that we need based on population growth.
That's Michael Weinberg, president of the Bay Area Council Economic Institute. He says if you adjust for inflation, Bay Area median rents have gone up by 25% in the last 4 years, and housing prices are up 60%. Chris Thornburg, the punchy economist, he gives some context.
The kind of issues we're talking about today, and I'm very glad to be here today, but I want to make it perfectly clear that we're talking about is not something very specific to the Bay Area or San Francisco. It's across our entire state.
He says, if you look at the numbers, the high rental prices in the Bay Area make sense. People here are generally making more money. In 2013, median household incomes in the metro area topped $79,000 a year. That's up from $62,000 at the end of the last dot-com boom. Thornburg thinks we need more homes to house wealthier people.
If gentrification is the concern, the answer is not so much what I would say try to stay in the way of progress, and more about just building the high-end units that these high-income people want to live in.
Now, if you're not one of those wealthier people, you might not like that idea. Thornburg knows that. But he says if you don't build for the rich, they'll go into middle-class neighborhoods and take the affordable housing.
So the true solution, you got to expand supply. If you want home prices to come down, if you want to make it more affordable, we simply need more supply. And that means, yeah, that means at some level, a lot of Californians and a lot of neighborhoods are going to have to accept the fact that their world's going to change. There's going to be densification. There's going to be more units, probably more traffic and more need for public transport. But if we want the state to grow, that's how you have to do it.
But this isn't just the Chris Thornburg show. And when Supervisor David Campos gets up to speak, he starts by slamming those ideas, saying they're a housing version of Reaganomics. Make favors for the wealthy and hope it trickles down to the middle and lower classes.
Didn't work in the 1980s. It's not going to work today.
Supervisor Campos represents most of San Francisco's Mission District, and that's ground zero for gentrification. The San Francisco Business Times has reported that he might propose a moratorium to stop building market-rate housing in the Mission.
And let me be very clear. those of us who believe that we need a change of course are not saying that we should not build.
He just wants to focus on building for lower-income people.
To the extent that the issue is that we need to build more affordable housing, the solution should be to actually build more affordable housing.
Campos says if we don't, we'll lose a lot more than just affordable units.
We are going to lose San Francisco as we know it. Because the thing is this, that in a presentation, those are numbers, populations change, but numbers. But what's unique about San Francisco is the diversity of the people we've had. And it is that diversity and that character that is being lost.
It's the truth. According to the San Francisco Association of Realtors, the average household income in the Mission is now almost $111,000. That's up 41% since 2000. And the Mission looks different racially, too. The news site Mission Local reports that from 2000 to 2010, the Latino population went down from 50 to 39%.
I think I can safely say I agree with everything that's been said so far.
To some extent.
That's Julie Pierce, the final speaker. She's the president of the Association of Bay Area Governments and former mayor of Clayton, a small town in Contra Costa County. Pierce says there's a bureaucratic culprit that's keeping enough housing from being built. It's CEQA, or the California Environmental Quality Act. It's supposed to protect the environment, but Pierce says
CEQA takes too long. It's too cumbersome. It is too demanding.
Ultimately, she says, current policies aren't working well for too many people.
Not everybody wants to live in downtown San Francisco. Not everybody wants to live out in the boonies. We all pick that mix, but our kids should be able to live there too. And right now, we're driving them out of the state. Thanks.
That's the bottom line. According to Zumper's National Rent Report, the median San Francisco one-bedroom apartment rents for around $3,400. In Oakland and San Jose, it's nearly $2,000. But if you look out of state, the price for one bedroom in Portland, Oregon is $1,300. Austin, Texas, just over $1,000. Jacksonville, Florida, $800 a month. Everyone at the panel agrees that the Bay Area needs to build. The question is, how? According to its latest pipeline report, the city of San Francisco has plans. More than 50,000 housing units are in the works. In San Francisco, I'm Liz Mack for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The surge in Bay Area development is a response to a surge in population, and that means a surge in Bay Area traffic. A new report from the Dutch mapping company TomTom ranks San Francisco as the second most congested city in the country. Only L.A. has it worse. And in times of gridlock, people often choose to take public transit, bike, or even walk to avoid driving. In San Francisco, it's the job of the Municipal Transportation Agency, the MTA, to make those alternatives as appealing as possible. Tom Nolan is chairman of the SFMTA. Nolan served on transportation boards throughout the Bay Area, including SamTrans and Caltrain. Now as Muni's chair, he's presiding over the board at a time of rapid change. Tom Nolan sat down with KALW's Raja Shah to talk about the current state of public transit in the city and where it might be heading.
You look at a system like New York, with an extensive subway system, mm-hmm. so much so that most people don't have cars there. Mm-hmm. Is something like that a possibility for San Francisco?
We did a strategic plan about 6 or 7 years ago that the goal ought to be that the very last thing you think about when going on a trip is getting your own private car by yourself. But that requires that Muni and all these other options be very attractive. And we're moving in that direction, buying a whole lot of new cars, new buses and metro cars. So we're making some progress in that respect.
What else? Is it just a lack of money, political will?
Well, the money is a huge thing. I just came back from D.C., and trying to get money from the Congress for transportation, which is difficult to do, this Congress especially. There's some political things, though. We're doing the bus rapid transit down Van Ness Avenue. And it's been studied for years now. And it should be under construction next year. But I was in Mexico City with a group looking at their BRT systems down there. They built four of them in 4 years. They carry 800,000 people a day with 1 minute headways. And so somebody said, well, what did you do about parking? We just took it. What can you imagine? The city, you know, all the different overlays of environmental, neighborhood, historic preservation, I mean, all those kinds of things. They slow it down for sure. Make it better, perhaps. But, you know, when it's in your neighborhood, that's alive and well. The NIMBY stuff is alive and well in San Francisco. And
so we're our own worst enemy.
I think in some ways, yeah. I mean, you kind of wonder, the great things that make San Francisco, you know, that are so famous, would they ever be built today? I don't know. You know, yeah, you think of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I don't know what kind of environmental work they did in those days, but I bet it was not a whole lot, not like today. You know, and there's clearly a place for the studies and everything, and you know, we're better for them, but it slows things down.
There was a controller's report that came out recently. Right. Half of Muni buses arrive either early or late. Right. Overtime has doubled in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. The fleet is often not fully available. Buses are aging. Yeah. What are the big issues you see right now?
Well, one of the things, like the Metro, it's just amazing. The average distance between breakdowns on a Muni Metro car like 5,000 to 6,000 miles. The new ones we're ordering, which should be here, some of them here next year, it'll be like 60,000 miles, and that alone is huge.
As far as the on-time performance, yeah. The MTA has a stated goal of 85% on time.
It's in the charter, yeah.
Is that realistic?
Well, I don't think so. if I had my way, we wouldn't have schedules, but we would have like. If you're riding on Geary during rush hour, there'd be a bus every 3 minutes. You know, it's not necessarily going to be at 6:27. It might be at 6:30, but there's going to be one every 3 minutes. And that, to me, is way more important and more reliable than, you know, putting out a schedule and trying to keep up with it. But it's in the charter. It would take a charter amendment. That probably would never, I don't know how that would fare. But, you know, we hear about on-time performance a lot. But in the city today, with all the construction going on, you know, it doesn't matter. Everything's going to be slowed down on the surface. It just has to be. It's amazing how many construction sites there are and how difficult it is to get around these places. So on time is not going to improve greatly, you know, until some of the construction stops. The new vehicles are here. But being in the traffic is just very, very difficult.
There's actually a lot going on right now with the transit system and a lot of jargon to go with it. There's transit first, mm-hmm. vision zero, mm-hmm. Muni forward, yeah. Transportation 23. Yeah. What does all of that mean for the average Muni rider in terms of what kind of changes they can expect to see?
Well, I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot of changes, a lot of really big changes. One of the first that's going to be major is the Muni forward, which used to be called the Transit Effectiveness Project. And that's going to bring people, that's going to upset a lot of people. But the overall good, I think, is going to be worthwhile. Because that involves, you know, eliminating some bus stops, consolidating some. And the most famous one on Van Ness, there are two stops for the 47 and 49 between Grove and McAllister. One on each end of the block. Now, it's a big block, granted. However, we recently, and the plan is going to actually have the one on McAllister survive and the one in Grove not. Well, the people in the arts community, the opera and symphony and all of that, wanted the other one because it's closer to there. But we're talking a block here. Two Muni stops and one block. I mean, really. The net effect eventually is going to be it's a much smoother system. People will appreciate it, I think. But there's going to be a lot of pain getting there.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Roger Shah speaking with Tom Nolan, the chairman of the San Francisco MTA. These ride-sharing apps, Uber and Lyft, right. are on the rise. Right. Also, there was news of a private bus company right. called yeah. Leap Transit, I believe,
yeah. mm-hmm.
that's going to be offering a bus from the marina to the financial right. district for $6 a ride.
Right.
I think I saw that you can buy blue bottle coffee and protein shakes for purchase.
Okay, we'll do that in Muni from now on.
You know, it gets at the larger question of what yeah. ought to be the role of the mm-hmm. private sector in the transportation system?
Well, it's a very interesting time, you know, for transportation. But I've always said the job of a commissioner is to look out for the city, but be mindful of individual aspects of it and parts to try to do what we can, a balancing act oftentimes. And I think there is a place for the private sector. But these folks need to step up too, in my opinion. I met recently with the officials from Lyft. They invited me to come and talk to them. And one of the problems with Lyft and Uber is about transporting disabled people. And Lyft is anxious to at least say to work with nonprofits to figure out a way that they can offer that kind of service as well. Because there are stories about somebody calling up Lyft or Uber and they have their guide dog or something and they won't let them in, you know. So that's got to be worked out. That really is a problem.
They've been engaged in a price war lately. I think Lyft recently had a campaign called Match Muni, where they were offering carpool rides for the same price as a Muni fare.
Oh.
Have there been conversations at the MTA about this new competition, essentially?
Well, you know, we regulate the taxis. And so the perspective we bring to it, essentially, is from that, you know, how this is impacting them and the people that they carry. We get accused a lot of not doing anything about Lyft and Uber and those things. But the state PUC took them over. And the regulations governing Lyft and Uber are much looser than the ones for taxis. And so that's a big part of the problem. And we haven't had enough taxis. And then so there's a vacuum created. This is my own view of it. The taxi industry was very resistant to change. They didn't want to accept credit cards, you know, and electronic waybills and all that, centralized dispatch. They didn't want to do all that. And so in the meantime, it makes a perfect opportunity for Lyft and Uber to come along and step in there. So you know, I'm not sure how this all going to play out. But right now, I think it's kind of uneasy, certainly between the cab drivers and the taxi companies and Uber and Lyft and those things. But I think some of these things will work themselves. I think it's room for everybody, really. I think that's the case.
That was San Francisco MTA Chairman Tom Nolan. He spoke with KLW's Raja Shah. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. If public transit is giving you the blues, maybe the best thing to do is just start tapping your feet and sing about it.
I know my little baby, she gonna jump and shout. That old train comes late, boy, and I come walking out, baby, I was trouble.
Howl Divine is a trio that's bringing the Southern blues to the Bay. For this episode of Bay Area Beats, we caught up with the founding members to find out how the blues got into their souls.
I'm Joshua Howell, and I play guitar, harmonica, and I sing.
And I'm Pete Divine, the drummer and percussionist of Howl Divine.
My parents had a great blues collection, so I would go through their LPs and listen to Sonny Boy Williamson and Lightnin' Hopkins and Brownie McGee and those guys.
It's basically the root of all rock and roll and forms of jazz and stuff. I mean, they were playing blues at the turn of the century. They weren't necessarily recording it until the early 20s, but from those types of blues, we got jazz, we got rock, we got all kinds of different styles of music. It's the foundation, basically, of American music.
When we play in clubs, I'm usually playing a Epiphone, an electric Epiphone. It's a like a Gibson 335. It's a hollow body electric guitar. And then I play harmonica. I play marine band. And then sometimes, like in the studio today, I play this. It's a 1931 National Duolian, which is a resonator guitar that a family friend left me when he died. He's the guy, Bruce Englehart, who originally got me into playing music when I was about 14. He suggested that I play harmonica instead of biting my fingernails.
Looks like you still bite them, though.
I still bite my nails. It didn't work, but I do play harmonica. So usually when you first pick up a harmonica, you're playing several notes at a time, and it just sounds like... and which isn't very nice sounding. And so I just practiced trying to get single notes, and just every day for, it took months, just every day until I could just getting single notes. And after a few months when I could just do that, then I was ready to move on and try to parse out some of the riffs that I was hearing, like in Sonny Boy Williamson's songs. That was he was the first person I really like tried to imitate. This tune's called She Brought Life Back to the Dead, which I originally heard on Sonny Boy Williamson's album King Biscuit Time.
When I first heard about her, I didn't believe what they said. When I first heard about her, I didn't believe what they said. Well, I found out for myself that she brought life back to the dead.
Most people, when they play the washboard, they use thimbles on their fingers, like metal thimbles on the ends of their fingers. And I never liked that because, well, first off, I use sticks. So when I'm playing my drum set, I'll grab my washboard and just play it all at the same time.
I call him the octopus because it seems like he has eight limbs going when he plays.
I put the washboard on my lap while I play the drums, and I use sometimes the washboard as my snare drum. So it's kind of an unorthodox style, but it kind of works.
The doctor said he was dead. People start walking out crying and shaking their head.
Well, we're signed with our Hooli Records, which is a legendary old roots and blues label based out of El Cerrito. Chris Drakowicz, it's his label. He's had the label since 1960. He started off in 1960, and he recorded all. He used to like run around the country doing field recordings of great old blues guys who were still alive back then, like Fred McDowell and Lightnin' Hopkins and Big Mama Thornton, Clifton Chenier. I mean, it's an honor. It's wonderful. I'll tell you a little something Chris told to us, like that first night he came to see us play. It's funny. He said, "You guys are the most rhythmic white people I've ever met." And that was very cool. Historically, yeah, it's blues is a black person's music, of course, but there's always the exceptions to the rules, and I grew up listening to it. Even though I'm from Maine, I grew up listening to those records of, you know, African Americans playing blues and jazz, from Louis Armstrong to Muddy Waters, and so it's in my blood and my soul. I think white people are just as capable of playing. It's about your surroundings.
That piece was produced by KALW's Julie Kane. And if you want to hear more from Howl Divine, you can see them live at the Freight and Salvage tomorrow night. Find details at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. And if you've got an idea for a local musician we should talk to, email us at news@KALW.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Olivia Cueva, Rachel Dornhelm, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ted Muldoon, Judy Silber, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Todd Whitney, and Liza Veal. Chris Hoff engineered today's show. The line producer was Audrey Dilling. The managing producer is Julie Kane. And the managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll take a look at a new program that's aiming to house groups of people from San Francisco's homeless encampments.
And then all of a sudden I hear her, "Baby, baby," she's screaming, right? And I'm thinking, oh, she must have found a rock or something because she likes rocks. And I stuck my head out the tent and she said, "Pack your stuff, they're coming to get us." And I was like, what?
We'll find out where they're going tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
I know I'm gonna pay.
This music is by Pacifica musicians the Chris Cobb Band. They take the stage at the Surf Spot in Pacifica on Saturday afternoon, starting at 1:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.